Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of the Spirit of Life in Ibiza podcast. Today's guest is Richard Stokes, who decided to quit his corporate job as an advertising executive with the world's biggest marketing firm when he realised that he was losing his mojo. To reconnect with his mojo, he decided to retrain as a life coach and move to Ibiza, where he set up his own business, Mojo Development, to help both individuals and businesses grow. Following on from the great success of his business, he is now hosting the Mojo Podcast so that other brave and fascinating people can share their mojo stories in a bid to inspire others to make the change that they need in their life. We are sat here today at New Blau Beach, recharging our mojos as the sun shines down upon us. This beautiful and quiet beach is located between Santa Eulalia and Escanar and is surrounded by palm trees and crystal clear waters. There is a coastal walk from here which takes you to Cala Martina, one of the island's most popular windsurfing beaches, a surefire way for anyone to recharge their mojo. So welcome, Richard, and thank you for suggesting the beach for today's location. I'm very happy about that.
It's not bad, is it? And you mentioned the coastal walk, and I guess we started part of it because we met at the beach and then walked around a bit to this headland, and it was a bit more of a mission than we suspected, but I think we've been rewarded with an amazing view down back onto the beach and just the sound of the waves in the background. So yeah, it's lovely.
And Ibiza's not a bad place to do location podcasts, is it?
I think it's an exceptional place to do location podcasts when you've got, what do they say, 300 days of sun a year, and I think that maybe is a conservative statement, actually. I think there might be more. No, it's lovely. I mean, the nature here is one of the things that drew my wife and I to the island in the first place. We weren't really kind of the party people, although we like to from time to time. But the reason we've always come here for holidays is the nature and the quality of the crystal water, the pine-laden mountains, and that's why we chose and now choose to call it home, and it's lovely.
And so, yes, so you actually, you lost your mojo in the UK, and I'm assuming you've very, very much found it since you've been back in Ibiza.
Yeah, you know, the process of, I've lost my mojo many times, by the way, in life, but the most recent, I think that led to the move to Ibiza and moving to running my own business, it was a kind of a slow and gradual one, and I think it happens in very different ways to different people. But really it was, I see my mojo as kind of my energy. And when my mojo is high and strong, my energy is flowing, I just feel great. I'm making decisions really easily. I'm less worried about what other people may be thinking. I have less of that self-talk, that gremlin that might go on in your head. So just bit by bit, though, I was losing kind of the joy of what I was doing. And I have, you know, I've had a very enjoyable 20 plus years in advertising agencies in the UK and doing UK-based jobs and global jobs. I've travelled an awful lot, met and worked with some wonderful people. But it kind of just got to the point where it wasn't quite enough. And, you know, when you're doing a corporate job, and especially when it's global, you travel a lot, you're spending an awful lot of time kind of on the road, working, away from home. And as I said, it wasn't quite enough for me. But I thought about what would be enough for me. What do I want to do? And that's a tough question to put to yourself. And actually, you know, I've retrained as a coach, and I had access to a coach, thankfully, with my previous company. And some of the best advice she gave me was really focus on what is bringing you joy. What is it that is making you jump out of bed every morning, rush into work, or get on that plane around the world? And for me, it was always helping to develop people. And that could be through training. And I did lots of training for our business, working with my immediate team as more of a mentor and a coach to them. So I thought, that's kind of where I want to be. And how do I do that? And bit by bit, you know, I guess opportunities presented themselves to me. And you can be in a mindset where you close off those opportunities. And I've been there a lot in life. But more so, I was more open to opportunity, and a executive coaching course was made available to me to get on with quite short notice, actually. And you know, it was funded by me, and I just thought, yeah, I've seen huge benefit in being coached. I would love to learn those skills, and I don't know how I'm going to manifest that and pass those skills on, but I want to have those skills, so I chose to do that. And bit by bit, as the course went on, I gained more confidence in it, worked with more people, and thought, this is actually what I want to do. This is what I'd love to base my business, whatever that looks like, around, and so be it, I did. And very much at the same time, my wife and I had been having a 2-year long conversation about where exactly did we want to live. London was home, one wonderful city, I think one of the world's great cities, so much going on, so dynamic, but also quite exhausting sometimes. And as I said, we were just drawn back to this place, Ibiza, where we spent a lot of holidays, and just with the calmness, the stillness of it, we thought maybe it's there. And all these things came together, and we've been here about a year and a half now, and it's wonderful.
No regrets.
No. I mean, you sort of have to pinch yourself sometimes. It isn't like living in a dream, or it can feel like that. We are very mindful of what we're doing to make our life here work, because it doesn't just get handed to you on a plate. Lots of things we have to put in place. My wife has found a fantastic job at a great school here. I've developed my business. But if I don't go out and find contracts and work, we don't get paid and we can't pay our rent and the dream ends, right? So it's pretty fundamental. So we keep working on it. But I think when you're mindful like that on what you're doing and why you're doing it, it becomes a lot simpler.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to go back and actually to something you said earlier from the life coach that you had. What great advice. Just do what makes you happy. It's the most simple and basic advice that there is, yet we have such a hard time doing it, don't we?
I think it's not given by everybody. Because the thing that what a coach does, a coach has no judgment and a coach has no agenda. So that is why that coach could say that to me. Now, my boss at work, and I've had some fantastic bosses, quite hard for them to say just do what makes you happy, because there was a whole lot of other work I maybe didn't make me quite so happy that needed to be done, and I understand that. But that's the position that the coach can take. And then so it's being offered that advice, then it's also accepting it, because believe me, a few years ago I'd have gone, yeah, I know what you mean, but, and I'd have found some excuses, put some barriers in the way that I kind of still have to keep doing this work. One of my core values is hard work and also loyalty. I've got a great employer and I need to be loyal to them. But then you also need to work out what's working for you, what's important for you.
Absolutely. Thank you for sharing that with us. And would you mind giving us a bit of a breakdown of exactly what a life coach would do for a person?
Yeah, so, everyone comes into coaching, I guess from different angles. Some people will come via their employer, and it could be very much it's a work-based development that needs to go on. Other people will maybe self-fund and seek out a life coach, and it's it could be a relationship challenge. It could be a wider career challenge. It could be how I'm living. It could be there's this marathon I want to do, and I just can't seem to get round to making time to get it done. It can be very, very specific. And actually, when you have a specific goal in mind, I think that's a really, really good time for coaching. I personally, when I first worked with my coach, I was a bit goal-less, actually, and she had to do a lot of work with me to get to some kind of, right, this is where you want to get to, and ended up being Ibiza and setting up my own business. But so having that, a sense of this is what I'm trying to do, I just need some support, and that's what coaching can be. It's fantastic, as I said, non-judgment based, no agenda based support to help you achieve your goals. And a lot of those goals come from a fantastic amount of self-awareness, because really what you're doing is you're talking about yourself. And for some of us, me included, that's quite uncomfortable, actually. I'm a listener, not a talker. This is quite strange for me right now, doing all this.
Well, thank you for agreeing to do it in that case.
I'm enjoying it.
I'm challenging you.
I'm enjoying it. No, it's good for me. But you have to get very comfortable with thinking about yourself, your values, your motivations, your strengths. But, you know, a coach will do it in an environment that makes you feel, as I say, very comfortable, very safe. A coach will build fantastic rapport with the client that they're working with. And that rapport, by the way, that can mean, okay, where's the best place for you to, for us to have this conversation? You know, a lot of these conversations might happen in a meeting room in an office. I've had some of the best sessions I've ever done actually walking with someone side by side, because there's a load of things going on there. You're actually not, some people don't like direct eye contact when they're really thinking deeply about themselves. And the act of walking, because there's bilateral movement and it's activating both sides of the brain, stimulates lots of new thinking. So you get to some amazing places. And that's, you know, that's what coaching is. It's the best thinking that you can do, because you're thinking out loud. You're not keeping those thoughts in.
Well, thank you. Well, as you're sharing that with me, you know, I'll tell you what's running through my mind right now. Why aren't we doing this in schools? Why are we waiting for adulthood when there's already so many... There's so much, you know, so much that we then have to work through and strip back. If we had life coaches at schools to really help with, you know, children to understand what their goals are and where they want to go in life. Unfortunately, the way our schools are set up currently, and I really hope to see it change in the future, but it's very much about being good at something, being good at maths, being good at science, being good at English. And if your gifts and talents lay elsewhere, they're often not nurtured, or you're told that that's not a good enough gift, because it, not in so many words, but you know, we're trained to make money. This is the thing, obviously, of course, that's the way our society is. We need to go out and make money. But then what happens when we go to the schooling system is that the children are kind of being set up to go out and earn money. So any gifts that come through that are deemed as not strong money makers will be pushed aside, whilst you're then told to get better at English, math, maybe get a tutor. And of course, what happens is that, you know, sometimes our parents, like trying to do the best for their children, will maybe pay for a tutor in one of these subjects. So the more time they're spending on trying to be average at something that they're maybe not as good at, they're spending less time on being incredible at the thing that they are good at. So we end up developing very average children instead of a child who is magnificent at something. I feel it would be amazing to just have a coach in there who really works to get to the bottom of what is it that's making this child tick. I know it's difficult because money is still a thing, but I do believe that if you're really passionate about something, really passionate, and you get up every day, and we've spoken about mojo here today, and you get up every day and you've got the mojo for life, you've got the mojo for what it is you're doing, that passion for what you're doing, I think you can make money out of that. It might not be, you know, a banker's wage, but I think you can do a really good job of getting by. And if you do something you're passionate about, you don't necessarily have to be grounded in an office. You could be traveling the world doing it. So there's so many more options that we don't explore, and it's beautiful that you're doing this job now and you're helping people to explore it, but wouldn't it be amazing if we explored it earlier on?
Oh, I absolutely agree with everything you're saying. I mean, I wish, and from a very personal level, I wish I'd had some of that guidance when I was at, you know, those formative stages, and you make some big decisions, don't you, quite early on in life, about which subjects am I good at, you know, i.e. how am I doing in exams? That's what we mean by that, really. And by, you know, I guess it's the age of 13 or 14, certainly in the UK education system, you've made some fundamental decisions about which way you're going. And that could be languages, sciences, in or out. And then what about all those other subjects that we place less value on, as you were saying? Why can't we bring some more of those in? So, yeah, from a personal level, I think that would have been great personally for me. And creating more access to guidance somehow in the school system would be fabulous. I mentioned my wife works here in Ibiza in a school. So the school's called Universal Mandala. It is kind of, it sits beautifully between Western philosophy and Montessori, the Montessori system, which is the child-led approach to education, which I'm sure lots of people will be familiar with.
And I'm a very big supporter of that kind of schooling system.
Yeah. And then the Eastern philosophy, essentially based in Buddhism. and it meets in the middle. And what I love about it is there is, you know, these kids. So right now, this school goes up to I think 6. In time, here in Ibiza, it will go up to 12. But the lessons are not labelled as maths and English and or reading and writing or anything like that. But the children are absolutely doing all of those skills and learning those skills, but they're also learning how to listen, how to share. They're learning patience. And you go, how can patience be taught? It absolutely can be when it's focused on. They're learning how to celebrate each other's successes. They're learning to be brave when they're making certain decisions. They're learning to forgive each other because, you know, these are little kids and sometimes they need to do a bit of that. And they're learning how to ask for help. What amazing life skills right there that these kids are getting that I don't know how many of us got that either consciously or subconsciously, formally or informally at school or from parents. And I'm sure a lot of this does come from parents and it comes through in values, but maybe it doesn't. And that's a big risk when it doesn't come through. So I'm all for more guidance somehow in earlier on in the education system, whether that's, you know, coaching or guidance, or, you know, the teachers in schools maybe having some of the training that I had in how to coach. And I know teachers, they're amazing listeners, because that's what I do. They're fabulous at it. I think just giving them maybe a bit more time during the pressures of the curriculum to really listen, to have those conversations with kids would be really powerful.
Makes me really happy just hearing that, you know, that your wife's working in a school like that, that there are schools like that around. It's something for myself. Long term, I actually plan to set up a school in an orphanage somewhere in South or Central America, and that's the kind of philosophy I want to bring in. One of the main things for the school that I would like to develop or build is to keep children connected to themselves, because what we do in our current schooling system is disconnect them from who they actually are, because we have this: if you're not good at this, then you're not good enough. If you're not like that person, then you're not good enough. And we kind of, I feel we strip, not just the schools, I feel, you know, I don't want to sound like I'm launching an attack on schools here, because schools are just working within the function, the normal function of the society that we have built. And it, obviously it happens at home, it happens in so many different ways, but we do strip children away from their individuality, and we try to we make children be like everybody else instead of being, you know, who they really are. And, you know, I feel a little bit like we set children up to fail at school, because we go into subjects where instead of exploring their natural gifts, and we have, as I've already said, you need to be good at English, you need to be good at maths. So we set up a system where we actually teach children to compete against each other. Which is why what you were saying before, I really like the fact what you were saying is they're teaching children to forgive, to understand, to have patience. But we're actually currently teaching children to compete, to feel good about somebody else's failure. And if we just allowed children to be the individuals that they actually are and express the way that they, you know, to express who they actually are in the way that they feel they want to express, no child could fail, because how do you fail at being you? You know, you can't fail at being you. But that being said, we do fail at being ourselves in the current system, because we actually aren't given permission to be ourselves. But if you really just connect to being you and allow yourself to be you, there is no way that you can fail. And you wouldn't want to compete against anyone else. You wouldn't want to be better than anyone else at anything. You just simply strive to be the best possible version of yourself. So that's the kind of school system that I would like to see.
And I think what you're saying is it's exactly of the moment, actually. Because, you know, when you talk about, you know, we are training our kids to be competitive, because people say, well, life's competitive. You know, there are not enough jobs for everybody, not enough money to go around. Well, actually, where our kids are now, the jobs that they'll eventually do don't even exist yet. So how can you say there won't be enough of them? Exactly what you said right at the beginning. You know, why are we training, teaching kids in a certain way that's quite linear, when those, we don't even know what they're going to be doing? So we have to be a bit more general about, you know, how we're guiding them, and, you know, some of those values that I talked about. There's a brilliant author called Simon Sinek, who's got a new book out or relatively recently, called The Infinite Mindset. And that's exactly about what you're talking about. It's not about having winners and losers, but it's about understanding there's plenty to go around, and it's just how you get your head around that and how you work. And, you know, he's written numerous books and he backs it all up. There's all great examples of companies and people that operate in that way. So it's all true. Somehow the education system needs to catch up.
Yeah, well, it sounds like an interesting book, definitely one that I need to read. And just going back to what you were saying there, if there's not enough jobs and not enough money to go around, we're training children to go do the same jobs, to chase the same dream, to chase the same jobs, to chase the same money. So if we actually allow children to do the things that they love and be more creative, more stuff would just, more roles, more jobs, more whatever would just naturally be created by being more diverse in the way that we're doing things in the first place.
I think that exactly that area of creativity is, I think I was going to pick one thing that is crushed out of children, unfortunately, at school, it's creativity. Because creativity generally equals art and those kind of subjects. I was terrible at art at school, and I still can't really draw, but I am creative. But there was no outlet for that, really, for me. And this is a long time ago, admittedly, and things have probably moved on a bit. But I still think there's, for some reason, you know, adults come out of being youngsters and the joy of play has absolutely gone. And so if you look at the workplace, there is no play in the workplace. It's not considered the right thing to do. But play is creative. And out of that creativity comes amazing thinking, abundant thinking that, as you said, takes you to new areas of opportunity and new revenue streams, frankly. Let's put ROI on it. That creativity does equal great return on investment.
Yeah, we just need to be a little bit more open-minded about it, really, don't we? If you look at, like, DJing is a huge industry, but you certainly wouldn't have been taught to be a DJ at school. And what I also find, you know, there's two different avenues. So there's the stress and frustration of exams, because what happens with exams is, personally, I believe an exam situation is, it's how good you are at retaining and then regurgitating taught information. It's not thinking outside the box. It's not being creative, as you just mentioned. It's not looking for other answers or other perspectives on the way we dealt with history, for example. With history, we're taught history. We're taught the facts of history, usually from the winner's point of view. Instead of having that kind of lateral thinking, where you'd maybe show both views in a classroom and then have the children talk about these different options. What would you have done differently? How could we have changed the outcome of that? How could we have stopped ourselves going for more? Really think it, because that kind of thinking is what stops us doing it going forward, right? But so you have this very the pressure of exams, which I'd like to come back to shortly. But you also have, we're measuring intelligence by the regurgitation of information that's taught. And we have many children, therefore, believing if they don't do well under exam pressure or aren't able to regurgitate that or hold that information, that they therefore aren't intelligent. So we're measuring intelligence by memory and the ability to be able to handle the pressure of an exam. In actual fact, intelligence comes in so many different forms, and intelligence can be very, very creative. But like you just said, we don't have that outlet. And as I mentioned earlier, DJ's a big thing. Like, a DJ is actually quite a revered job. Like, there's lots of people who want to be a DJ. Everybody loves a DJ.
They seem to make quite a lot of money, if we're going to boil it down to that.
They do. They make money. They have a great time. They travel the world. Yeah. They get the girl, if we're talking from a masculine point of view. You know, they've got a lot going on, but that's not something that's developed in a school. And I'm just using that as one example. It's certainly something that in the orphanage and the school that I set up, I want to bring that in. And not just DJ. I want to bring so many different things in. And I guess the argument that would come back is, you know, how can a school support or afford so many different subjects or so many different avenues? But we've got the internet now, So there's so many online classes that you can do. And, you know, if you said to a DJ, I'm using this as an example, hey, you know, would you be up for coming in and giving our class a bit of a lesson and just at least allowing them to feel for it? And then you could find out, okay, well, there's actually 20 kids who'd love to do this.
I think that's the key. I think there's exposing kids to just as much stuff as you possibly can. They can soak it all up and they'll have they'll get an affinity with that. There's something about this that I really like. I'm not really sure what it is or why it is, but I like it. And then they have the opportunity to go off and get into it further, right? So I think there are a lot of people, I'm sure this does happen in some really good schools, that people in the community are asked to come in. Could you showcase what you do? Could you come in and talk about what you do? So that, you know, the kids coming through the school aren't just thinking about, well, here are the standard professions, here's what my parents do, and that's kind of my frame of reference. It really is about expanding that frame of reference for what opportunity looks like. And, you know, you used the word intelligence earlier. I think it's emotional intelligence, isn't it? That's what, again, can that be taught? Yes, it can be taught. If it's focused on all those principles and values I talked about at my wife's school, that is emotional intelligence. So with those things coming together, you know, the access to opportunity and more emotional intelligence, I think schooling looks a lot brighter and future focused, future ready. That's the purpose of education at the end of the day.
Yeah, because emotional intelligence is what our society needs to be based on. And unfortunately, we are lacking a lot of it. And so then we complain about the issues that we have in society. But if our basic foundations of a schooling system aren't preparing people to go into society, I feel we end up creating these broken children, because we're pulling them from the true identity of who they are. We're not allowing them to express in the way that they want to. They get frustrated. There's a whole avenue of things that happen, but we create these broken children and then we send them out to an already broken society and expect them to function. And the society that we're living in isn't functioning to a high degree. It's not functioning the way that it should be functioning. And I really do believe that, of course, parents are, you know, an integral part of that. But all parents have different ideas. And if we have a schooling system that can really come together and just allow these children just to be who they are, I just think I've said it a few times now, we need to let these children be who they are. But it is the most integral part of everything. If we don't feel that we can be who we are, if we feel that we have to be somebody else, if we feel that we have to compete with somebody else to be better than them, to make ourselves feel whole, how can we expect to ever really live a happy life? How can we expect to function in society?
Yeah, fitting in is hard, isn't it? I mean, I think probably most kids at some point feel they have to try and fit in, and then that perpetuates, because then you fit in into a corporate environment, you fit into your friend group, and it goes on and on, and it's a real shame when people feel they can't be themselves. And that is such a waste of potential when you're not being yourself. It takes a lot of energy as well, having that mask or whatever, however you want to describe it, of being somebody else. God, it's exhausting. So when you can actually be a bit freer and be yourself, then it's great. And honestly, this is me in the last probably 5 or 6 years, so I'm really feeling like I'm being myself, and I put a lot of those masks on too. More of that.
And it's exactly the same for me. I mean, I used drugs for a long time when I was younger, as a way of escaping from all of that, because I just didn't know who I was. I was so disconnected. I didn't know what was real, and I absolutely lived behind this mask. And it's taken me many, many years to remove that mask. But I have to say, like, having done it, it's a lot of hard work doing it, because this is the thing, as adults trying to undo all of the work, all of the negative connotations that have happened, trying to undo all that is hard work. You have to really face yourself, and we don't want to face ourselves, because we've lied to ourselves for so long. You know, we've lied to everybody else saying that we're something that we're not, but we've lied to ourselves as well. And trying to face the reality of who we are, warts and all, can be really, really hard to do. But once you've done it, it's it's a beautiful experience, and it's part of the journey. It's part of our soul's evolution, if you like. It's the journey that we're going through. But I think as consciousness is shifting now, like, there is this really powerful shift, and as it's happening, I think what we now need to see is a way of, like, allowing the soul to step into who they are from an early stage, allowing themselves to be nurtured, allowing them to, you know, to really be true to who they are. Because if, can you imagine if a child is allowed to do that from an early age, the power that they would hold, the power to be themselves, the gifts, the strength of the gifts that they would have. Because I know with my gifts, I've said for a long time, when I worked as a stockbroker, I used to say, I have no gifts and I have no talents. I'm good at my job and that's it. But actually, what's happened since leaving my job, and my creativity has now been able to flourish. I mean, it was my creativity had dwindled to next to nothing when I was working. But as it's been able to flourish, I'm discovering more and more gifts that I didn't even know I had. But when I actually look back to my childhood, I actually was very gifted as a child. I was born gifted. And I'm saying this not as an egotistical thing, because I believe this of every child. I was born gifted, and my parents did actually really try to nurture my gifts. They took me to a lot of different outside classes. Mm. So they did try, but I wanted to be like my friends. I wanted to be like everyone else. I wanted to do is fitting in, exactly. So I ended up leaving a lot of these things. But, you know, if everyone, if it was set up so that everybody did this, that everybody explored their gifts individually and naturally, and this was accepted and this was good, can you imagine how powerful you would be to have had that gift and explored it and nurtured it and grown it through your whole life? We would be very, very powerful individuals. You're telling me you couldn't make money off of that kind of power?
Well, that's it. Power, potential, fulfilling potential. And that, you know, you asked me about coaching and what that's about. It's really about that. So, you know, helping people a bit later in life, because, as I said, the education system maybe doesn't help enormously right now, but eventually people get to the point, I think there's something else I should be doing. How can I do that? And that's a lot of many of the conversations I have. And I'm not saying it's everyone, it's not quit your job, move to Ibiza. It might be that within the organisation you're in, there could be something else that's more for you, that's better for you, or working in a different way, finding different ways to look at problems, being more creative. When you've been told that you're not creative from a really young age, it's really hard to get. You actually are. You are very, very capable of creative thought and getting that confidence. And that's a lot of what I do personally in my sessions, is about confidence building through people really understanding their strengths. And you talked about gifts as a child, and we all got that. And some are shone upon really brightly, and they lead to something, but many aren't. But we all have strengths, and really understanding those and focusing on them and trying to turn those strengths into what I call superpowers is a really worthy thing to do. Because then you become really known for those things, and you can succeed. And then there's economic, if you want to boil it down to that, benefit for you and maybe even your employer as well.
Yeah, and you mentioned creative. We are all creative beings. And you've also mentioned confidence there. And yeah, I think this is the thing, is again, the way that the system is set up is that we just aren't confident at being us, and we're not confident with the gifts and the things that we have. But what sort of happens is, if those gifts, passions and dreams are taken away from us, and this need to make money, we start to really lose ourselves, and we start to lose who we are. We lose our connection with source, we lose our connection with self, and then we become very, very frustrated. And then we see this, you know, it's definitely a culture in the UK where people go out every night annihilating themselves on drink and drugs because they're so frustrated, so bored, so just done in with the life that they're leading. But people are scared of change, and you also mentioned change earlier. And I know that you mentioned to me previously that you would actually like to see, again as part of a schooling system, the ability to handle change being taught in the schooling system as well.
Yeah, I think the ability to handle change comes from literally doing it. To make big change, you've got to look at the small ones you've made and understand, again, coming back to confidence, that I can do that. And I think what can happen is you can go through life, and maybe you haven't had to face too much adversity. A lot of us have, but maybe you haven't. So you haven't been forced to make change. So if you get to a point in your life, maybe you're in your late 30s or 40s, and you really are forced, this could be a relationship breakdown, this could be redundancy at work, then you have no frame of reference, you have no skills for handling that change, and you have very little confidence for that change. And that's not a great position to be in to try and make the best decisions around that situation that you're in. So, and I don't know what the answers are here, but somehow experience is being shared. I think it's just around talking more and sharing that change does happen. It's okay. It's okay to fail at stuff. Maybe it's around that. And you see, it's kind of interesting. You look at a lot of kind of the Californian tech companies, and they'll talk about fail. And failing's good, and fail fast. And that's okay if you're genuinely not judging around that failure. And the jury's a bit out for me on some of that. But if in, again, can bring it back to the schooling system, that maybe not nailing something the first time is seen as okay, that starts to build up a certain resilience. And that starts to help with you understanding around change and the skills that you need to make change. Yeah.
And as we talk about change there, I know you've also mentioned to me previously the ladder of fear. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
So, yes. When faced with change, either one we think we want to make or one that's maybe put upon us, humans will have a tendency, some more than others, to catastrophize. Now, what is the worst that can happen, rather than what is the best that can happen out of this situation? So there's an exercise that I work with my clients on. It's not something I invented. It's what a lot of coaches use. This. It's called the ladder of fear. And essentially, what you do, you start. You can actually draw a ladder out on a piece of paper, and then each rung or step of the ladder is a move towards disaster. And it would start with something like, "Okay, I've seen this job advertised internally at work. I'd really like to go for it, but I'm scared about, you know, failing." And then what I ask my clients to do is, okay, let's step that through. So you apply for the job, you get the job, because you're very qualified for it. You fail at the job. What happens next? Oh, I fail at the job, I'm made redundant and my reputation is kind of shot in the marketplace and no one wants to employ me. I can't get another job. I can't pay my mortgage. I lose my house. I lose my wife, obviously my children as well. I'm on the street. I become a drug addict and I die. Like, oh my God, all from going for a job? And then I do ask in that kind of way, and the person might go, yeah, it does sound maybe a bit far-fetched. But what we do was step through each of those steps of the ladder, each of those disasters that flows, and we just talk about the likelihood, the real practical likelihood of that thing happening. And guess what? You tend to be able to debunk each step of that ladder, and you don't get to dying alone in the gutter. You actually go a different way, and maybe because I'm totally qualified for this job, I've got some great skills and strengths, I'm a massive success at it. But you have to kind of draw that out, because that is sitting there. That is what's holding us back, this fear, this ability to catastrophize around a situation. And yeah, I find it a very, very effective tool. And you could do it with a coach. You can do it yourself. You can do it with a friend who's maybe facing up to making a change, making a decision, but is really uncertain about it. And just tease that out with them. And you know, listen in a very non-judgmental way and without an agenda, and then you're coaching. That's really helpful.
It sounds great. Thank you for sharing that tip with us. And yeah, fear, it's a huge thing. It's instilled in every single one of us. And I mean, I lived a life of fear for a very, very long time. I've learned to walk hand in hand with fear, rather than pushing it out altogether. I hope one day it will be gone altogether, but for now it's walking hand in hand. And one of my biggest fears actually was public speaking. So I actually had to be hypnotized even to stand in a room with eight people on a very low-key public speaking course and just stand and look at the audience and say, hi, my name's Niabi. I had to be hypnotized 3 times for that. And here I am holding my own podcast series. So, you know, it's taking one step at a time, because what you were just saying about catastrophizing, we look at like the big overall picture or the potential catastrophe of the overall picture. I have visions about where my life's going, the work I'm going to be doing in my life. And when I look at the end result vision that I'm seeing, it's terrifying. I think, how am I going to get there? But I think it's really important, instead of trying to get from A to Z and missing out crucial steps, we need just to do, let's just take A to B and B to C, because at each point, it's like a treasure hunt unfolding. At each point, you get the next clue that takes you to the next stage. And I think if we can learn to just strip things back and take things one step at a time, instead of looking at, you know, the whole picture and just wondering how. Because life's beautiful. It has a beautiful way of unfolding around us. And we don't know what's going to unfold until it unfolds. But as I say, at each step, you get new information and a new clue that takes you to the next part. So, yeah, when people live in fear like this, you know, what do we think happens next? And we only have to look at our society to see what fear breeds. It breeds contempt. It breeds frustration and disconnection from source. It breeds the need for people to go out and get annihilated night after night to escape, as I've already mentioned. But we also have a really high suicide rate in our society as well. And men particularly, I think a man is 3 times more likely to die from suicide than a woman, which would lead to say, you know, that these frustrations aren't necessarily being spoken about. And so this is, you've mentioned this earlier, like there's a lot of things that need to change in our society, but until we start talking about it, and it's not just talking, it's listening, because I know that there's a lot of times when people just want to shut people up when they're talking, and maybe don't listen to what's been said. They're very stuck into the way that our society is. It's always been like this, so therefore it should continue like this. And I think we need to start opening up and listening to people's views and people's opinions. But of course, you know, when it comes to suicide, we actually need to start listening, creating a supportive environment where people who are having problems maybe functioning in society, or people are having problems functioning behind their mask, maybe. We need to create a society where, or a place where people can open up and talk about those fears without fear of repercussion or without fear of judgment. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is such a desperately sad area to talk about, and you're right with the stat, and I heard another one recently about suicide's the biggest single killer of men in the UK under 50. The biggest single killer. And you know, if that was heart disease or cancer, we'd be really... I mean, we're trying to tackle those things, and we are trying to tackle suicidal ideation as well. But there's so much more that can be done. And there's great work, I think, happening in a lot of workplaces now with mental health first aiders. You see a lot of companies who are training people up, who can have conversations with people, who can recognise when someone isn't okay. And if the organisation understands it's okay not to be okay, and if culturally that can really be understood and is true... And I think that has to, like a lot of great culture, has to come from the top. There has to be vulnerability shown by your leadership to say, you know, sometimes I'm not okay. And to talk about stories in their lives. You know, I've lost 3 really good friends to suicide. 2 at a very similar time. It was, you know, we were talking about exams earlier. This was actually university exam times and finals. And all that pressure, and you're 21, 22, you've had... You know, maybe you've had this amazing 3 years of experience at university. It's coming to an end. And as you said, you're having to regurgitate all the information that you've learned in that time. And it's incredibly stressful. And yeah, 2 of my friends chose to take their lives at that time when the exam results weren't what they wanted them to be. And I just think it's just so desperately sad. And talking masks, I was with one of them, Mark, the day before. I had absolutely no sense. And was I a mental health first aider? No, I wasn't. Could I have spotted some signs? I don't know. I asked myself that question an awful lot, I have to say. And I'd hope now I could spot that. And then more recently, another friend I used to work with, different circumstances, but, you know, with a family, a young family, on the surface of it, a successful job, and he's very, very good at his job, and decided it wasn't enough, and yeah, just awful, just awful.
Yeah, it certainly is very sad, and I'm sorry that you've lost so many people to you know what. Effectively, it's a disease. It's a disease of our society. In actual fact, according to the World Health Organization, one person dies every 40 seconds from suicide. And that is apparently improved statistics. One every 40 seconds. God. And as well, also according to the World Health Organization, suicide is most prevalent. The highest rates are actually in high-income countries, which again just shows the pressures that are being put on people. To be something that they're not, to perform in a way that they don't necessarily want to perform in, but they feel that that's what they have to do. And I couldn't help but think when you were talking about your friend who who committed suicide after the exam results, and all I kept thinking was, I bet he was this. There was so much creativity in him that was unrealised because everything's on the exam pressure and performance and trying to make money.
Yeah, I mean, both of those guys, when it was at that stage at post university, both massively into music. I could just kind of foresee the kind of industries that have got into the work they would have created. It would have been very, very different, probably, from what they were studying, frankly, because that didn't really define them. But I talked about the expectation of society. And this is, this is over 20 years ago now. So I really hope and I do think some things have moved on. But unfortunately, the stats are still there. And, young men, I said men under 50, are still deciding that it's better to end their life than to continue with a life living in a certain way or to make certain change. And it's just desperately sad. But we have to, we have to think of it as a disease, and we have to have the best minds, the best intention people to think, how are we going to change this? How are we going to change this narrative? Because it's not changing right now.
No, and I really believe that change in school system could be exactly what we need to really help with that. I feel like we, I mentioned earlier, we create broken children and then send them out to a broken society. But so what's happening there is we all have this void inside of us, because we're not fulfilling our true potential. We're not being the people we were born to be. We're not expressing our souls in the way that we want to. And then we get caught up in this lie, really. So we're walking around with like this void that we're looking to fill. That void is self-love, because how are we able to love a lie? We're not, we don't trust ourselves and our abilities. We're competing against other people to try and be them instead of being the best possible version of ourselves, as I mentioned earlier. And so because we're trapped in this cycle, it's very, very difficult for us to give ourselves self-love. So we end up then looking for love in the arms of another. This is a very common cycle that happens as well. But with that, if I'm looking to you to make me happy and to make me feel loved and whole, and you're looking to me to make you feel happy and loved and whole, then how can either of us make each other happy and feel loved? And we'll feel it for a while, of course. I mean, when you first meet someone and you fall in love, everything's incredible. But after a while, the cracks on that start to form. And it's not necessarily the cracks of the relationship, because it may be that you got, that couple are very much meant to be together. But if you're both trying to make the other one happy, it's not sustainable for a long period of time. And this is a tough one to hear for people as well. But I think what happens then, like two people then stay together because they actually are in love, but then maybe start to look to fill the void by having children. So then the children come in, and It's very difficult. It's not just people looking to fill a void with children. There are people who are very ready to have children as well, who bring children in. But if you have not learned to love yourself fully and truly, how can we teach our children to do the same? So then, you know, you can try, you can tell them, you can say everything that you feel that you should be saying to them, but children lead, children follow by example. And so if children see the behaviours and the actions of the parents who are acting from a place that's not, or coming from a place that's not whole, that's not full of self-love, then that child is going to pick up those same behaviours and copy that. So it's very, very difficult. And I know that when I'm saying this, you know, people are going to be thinking, are you crazy? How do we change that? But we have to start somewhere. And I think the recognition of this, the awareness of this, is key. Obviously, there's a long healing process that comes with this. You know, there's many of us, many people in our society who don't love ourselves fully, and I'm one of them. It's taken me a long time to feel that love for myself. I'm getting there. It's taken me a long time to be able to say, "Hey, I'm beautiful," because I didn't believe that of myself, and I still choke on the words a little bit now. So there is a really long healing process there, and I'm not suggesting that everybody just stops having children in the meantime. Obviously we need children for to carry society on, but the awareness of it is really, really important. And as I say, we have to start somewhere. And I mentioned earlier, going, instead of looking at A to Z, we just need to go A to B and just take that one step at a time. But it really is something that we need to think about, and we all need to start working on ourselves and that void that we feel within ourselves. And hopefully the recognition of where that void comes from will actually help us to take step one to get to at least to A, at least to stand up on the point of A. This is very much what my book is about, and I'm not using this as a way to plug my book, but these words that come through are words of spirit. And what spirit is trying to say there is there's a line in it that says, every one of you has a gift that will help to heal the rift. And so by exploring those gifts that we've spoken about today, by recognizing what your dreams are, what your talents are, you actually start to naturally heal yourself. Because to walk the path towards your dream is to walk the path that heals you. So if we can start doing that naturally, like slowly, step by step, we will start to inflict those changes. And by inflicting those changes, we start to then feel the love. And then when we feel that love for ourselves, we're then able to pass that on to our children, who then hopefully by that time are going into a schooling system that is supporting and nurturing that. It's simple changes, yet not simple, because it's hard work, but it's a simple awareness that I think can start this change, and this shift of consciousness that's happening at the moment, I think, will support that. And I think that change, we will start to ride the waves of that change. But part of the reason I'm doing these podcasts is really just to help people to really inspire people just to think a little bit more about the changes that we can make, rather than just living by the rules that society has currently or has always inflicted upon us. So yeah, any final thoughts?
Well, just sitting there nodding my head an awful lot, which no one can obviously see when it's a podcast, but yeah, just great words, great thoughts. I just, you know, all changes that are worth making take a little doing, but you know that the first step is the most meaningful, and then you take another step and another step. So yeah, you know, it's been great chatting about it all, and I think, yeah, just if it provides anybody with just some inspiration about, I can actually maybe live my life a little differently, or I can think about things in a slightly different way and that's more true to me, then that's a great thing.
It really is, isn't it? And like you said earlier, it's not everybody is going to pack up their life and move to Ibiza or across the country, but it's just bringing those small little things back into people's lives. And it's that one step thing again, but just bringing that one piece of joy, that one thing that makes your soul sing, back into your life. And that, you know, that from one piece of happiness, the next unfolds. And energy is contagious. You know, you bring that one little thing of joy back into your life, and then the next one rolls, and the next one rolls, and suddenly you look back and think, wow, why didn't I do this sooner, quite frankly. But yeah, so thank you so much, Richard, for coming and being my guest today.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. See you here in the sun. Have a nice chat. Well, it's a nice chat, more than a nice chat, a really meaningful conversation. So thank you for inviting me.
It's been great. And thank you once more for suggesting the beach, because it's been truly beautiful. So, tune in next time, guys. Thanks very much.